Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I am your host, Christopher Hart. Can you hear that? Yeah? Tap, tap, tap? Or you're talking about my voice?
Well, I can hear your voice, I hear you tap.
Also. Okay. All right. Well, let's not do that. This week, I sit down. We're on site at Jack Daniels. This is one of their boardrooms. We were lucky enough to get in here to sit down with Chris Fletcher, the assistant master distiller of Jack Daniels. And we just wanted to talk whiskey, talk about the biggest brand in the world, the number one selling whiskey globally, whose impact has been undeniable and legendary in every sense of the word. And yeah, so again, Sean joins us today, my brother-in-law, Sean. Today he talks a little bit more. And we had just a great time. I mean, this company has done more for whiskey and for especially for Tennessee whiskey than any other company I can think of. So today was really special. This week's show, as always, is sponsored by Terlato Distill Artisan Spirits, leader in premium artisan products like Bunahabhain, Deanston, Lecheg, Tobermory, Baines, Black Bottle, and Scottish Leader. You can pick up the entire line at your local liquor store, or if you are a retailer, reach out to your United Wine and Spirits rep. Just a reminder to everybody, we have all of our shirts and merchandise up at WhiskeyMerch.com. That's right. That beautiful URL is mine, WhiskeyMerch.com. It's whiskey with the E. You can get our shirts, shirts for the Whiskey Social, Whiskey Pete, the whole nine yards, including ESPN, our show, Whiskey Neat logo, merchandise. Please rate and review the show. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, literally every podcast platform, including iHeartRadio and Spotify. I think that pretty much covers all of our bases. Without further ado, Chris Fletcher from Jack Daniels Distillery. Cheers. Thanks so much for doing the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
We actually met a couple years ago. We met for the first time right in December of 2017. You guys rolled out that beautiful, beautiful barrel proof program.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had been asking about it for years, and when it finally came up, the local guys, Costa, was like, "Hey, this has come up. Do you want it?" Absolutely. And it went really well. There's been a few people to do it in Houston. And now when that first came out, actually, I think you guys were capping it at 60 barrels, and I think we had a brief discussion at the Motlow House about plans to expand that, or you know, what do we have updates on that? I haven't heard anything in a while.
Yeah, we'll do more than 60 this year. I think probably closer to 100. The reason that it's so limited, if you think back, you know, that product, you know, started coming out, you know, about a year and a half ago now, and that's a, you know, 5.5-6 year old roughly whiskey. And so if you go back to when we were making that whiskey, there was no such thing as a barrel proof offering from Jack Daniels.
Sure.
And so we're pulling from the standard single barrel stock to produce that finished product, and so you only have what you can pull out of that standard single barrel 94 proof offering that we have out there as well. So now that's the thing, it wasn't planned to have a barrel proof offering 6 years ago when we were making that whiskey.
Sure. And it's been going really well, I imagine. I mean, 100. Is there a limit on your standard single barrel? Like, what you guys are like, 400, I think, 600 barrels a year?
Not as much. I mean, there's no allocation on it or anything like that. We intentionally put away more barrels than we anticipate we're going to need for standard single barrel stock. Of course, we never really truly know. The thing about production planning is, at a distillery, when you're 5-6 years out, whatever, you know you're going to be wrong. You're probably going to make too much, or you're not going to make enough.
Sure.
But because single barrel is it's a little different for us, because it's only about roughly 1% of what we make, so it's hard to go in and guarantee that. We know when we put barrels away in certain barrel houses on those top floors, which all of our single barrels are only coming from top floors because of the temperature change that they get up there. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of target an area based on our history that we believe we'll make single barrel whiskey from this location, but there's no guarantee.
Sure.
Right? So the master panel has to approve it.
Thank you.
And that's where, you know, that a little bit of unknown comes into play, right? It's always the science and the art.
Sure.
That comes together when you're doing whiskey.
So making too little or too much, if you if you were to overshoot, right? Mm-hmm. Can you pull those back and batch or bring them into the...
Exactly.
Okay.
You got it right.
So you can recycle.
Yep. You're right. So certainly with single barrel whiskey as well, top four whiskey, that's going to go into standard Jack Daniel's Old Number 7.
Right. Right.
I mean, it's very common.
I would imagine overshooting, it's probably the safer bet because you can always use the juice, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's not like it's... going to be off for use anywhere else. The grain bill is the same. The process is entirely the same. What creates that single barrel character is really the maturation process. Mm-hmm. But you can take some of those barrels in the right amounts, mix that into Old Number 7, which is going to be about a 200 barrel batch, and you're going to have barrels coming from multiple locations, the bottom, the middle, the top.
Sure.
So
consistency. Yeah.
Consistency. Yeah. Yep. Got to have consistency.
Blending it all.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And this may not be public knowledge. How many, because you guys are the number one selling whiskey in the world. How many barrels do you guys have resting right now? Is that out there?
We've got a lot. Probably near that 2 million mark is where we're at. We're roughly, a good rule of thumb for us, 2,000 barrels a day. That's about where we're at.
Barreling, 2,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
Wow. Like okay, so then that makes, I was at a tasting with Harlan Wheatley about a year ago, and he was talking about how everyone's playing catch up. Everyone's trying to catch up with what's going on. Right now, production is not, the demand is higher than what a lot of people were estimated for a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't remember if he was saying they were doing 1,000 barrels a week or 1,000 barrels a day. And they put in a bunch of new still. I think it would make sense then. They're probably doing at least 1,000 barrels a day at Buffalo Trace. I know you wouldn't know that. I'm thinking through. Mm-hmm. Literally for a year, I couldn't remember if it was 1,000 a day or 1,000 a week. But if you guys are putting down 2,000, I didn't think it was possible. But 2,000 a day is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that would be considered an average day for us. Yeah.
And everything gets bottled here, right?
Yeah.
So I know that you guys have. A ton of different label designs, different offerings, and you come through Lynchburg, it's pretty peaceful and quiet, and it's hard to imagine that on a global scale what you guys are able to put out, everything happens right. I know that everything distilled here because that you guys advertise that every drop right here, but it's pretty crazy that all that happens in one spot.
Yeah,
nowhere.
Well, we expand. Every year, typically we build a new barrel house at a rate of about one, maybe two a year. I'd say about one a year. Currently, the barrel houses we build will hold over 60,000 barrels.
That's double than I would say the average, right? The average is 30,000?
You see all kinds of different sizes. Kind of the old school, back in the 60s, 70s, they were around 20,000. Was kind of the average is what you see out there a lot. They've gradually increased over the years, as we can make better houses.
Sure.
And make sure that, obviously we're going to get not only the quality of the whiskey that we have to have, but also make sure that the safety and everything of the house and operating in and out with our people, and that we can control that environment, and obviously, risk management and things like that. There's lots of technical things that go into building a storage facility for 60,000 barrels of high proof alcohol.
A lot of weight. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of things.
Did the conversation come up at all with you guys? Sometimes what happens, like with the Heaven Hell Fire in 93, it ended up, the entire industry was discussing ways to improve fire suppression systems, ways to deal with those things. When the 1792 thing happened, did you guys have a discussion about structural, I don't know if that had made rung, because when's the last time we saw a warehouse collapse?
Yeah, assessing current warehouses, stuff like that.
Yeah, we continually do that. That never doesn't happen here. We inspect, we have employees that work in our warehousing crews that their jobs are to go in and inspect the ricks and everything for their integrity. We have plumb bobs in every barrel house as well. The way that we load in and out of these houses are,
balanced.
Yeah, it's
done how aircrafts are,
at a specific way to ensure that the integrity of the house doesn't change. And we're constantly doing repairs. I mean, we have 89 houses right now.
89.
So we're constantly upkeeping and maintaining these houses for sure. Nothing really prompts us. I mean, it's very unfortunate when there's an accident of any kind. Don't get me wrong. but it's not going to really change what we do here.
So with 89 houses, is there a frame? So I'm, you know, obviously this the time span, right? 1 to 2 a year, potentially, whatever. They've mm-hmm. obviously evolved over time. You probably mm-hmm. have a much different house now than you had down, you know, on your first few that were ever created. Is there a framework that you follow? Is it ever evolving? Do you get better and better? Is there, do you find things that work yeah. and just change?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it, you know, at the end of the day, it's still basically a box with a bunch of barrels in
sure.
it.
Sure.
But, you know, the things that affect aging whiskey, temperature, obviously. I think everybody mm-hmm. kind of knows that. Airflow is a big thing. Humidity. You know, you're always going to have, you know, this layering effect in a house just simply because of the insulation factor of what that much liquid is going to do, right? Mm-hmm. The whiskey will insulate itself on lower floors. So, for instance, right now, okay, we're getting spring to summer. We're really starting to get into our heat cycle. But if you went into one of our barrel houses on the bottom floor, you it would feel kind of cool. I mean, I wouldn't say cold, but, you know, it might be, you know, the humidity is going to be pretty high in there and make it feel colder than it is. But you might walk in and it's
pretty insulated.
60
right?
degrees, right? Yeah, it's very insulated. And you're thinking, well, you know, are you cycling these houses? And we don't. You go up 3 or 4 floors, temperature will probably rise 10 degrees. You go up to the top, probably rise another 10 degrees. We could easily see 20 degrees of, you know, stratifying layers of temperature in a barrel house.
So we could literally sell our wives on just putting our attic, filling it with whiskey barrels
for insulation
and insulating our house and saving energy costs.
Good luck.
Yeah. Well, in Texas especially, it sounds I won't say who, although it's pretty public. There was a Texas chiller who was aging in storage containers. Mm. Cooking the whiskey gets like 180 degrees in there, and the result was a pretty intense effect from the barrel and the liquid.
Yeah,
I our attics have, especially in Texas, just it'd be way too hot.
Yeah.
So are you guys worried? I mean, I'm sure you're not worried about it, but with 89 warehouses, the first thing that comes to mind is how much land is left on the property for you guys to continue building a warehouse a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there enough room?
Especially since we're in the second smallest county in the state, right?
Yeah. Is there, yeah. How much land is left? I mean, are you guys have estimated, I'm sure there's been someone that said, look, our property could probably hold no more than 150 rick houses.
Mm-hmm.
Has that happened? Is that discussion?
We are right now, we own about 2,500 acres here. And so there is no restriction as it goes right now. We've got plenty of land. You know, maybe one day we'll have to buy a little bit more. And as we need it and as, you know, land becomes available, I mean, it's, you know, production planning is, sure. I mean, you know, just like any other industry would, you know. So mm-hmm. certainly the biggest footprint that we have is for barrel houses, right? The distillery itself is not a big physical footprint. Bottling is quite a bit larger, but not as big as what you need for barrel houses because you have to space them out. But then you look at the flip side of that. The other thing that we can do to counteract that is fit more barrels under one roof, which is what we're doing now. So traditionally, a barrel house here would be about 20,000 barrels, right? Now the ones we build are closer to 70,000 barrels. So we're able to safely maintain a larger warehouse to fit more whiskey under one roof, which
are you
certainly
talking larger this way, or are they still all the same or growing up?
Both.
Yeah,
both.
What's the tallest?
We have all different sizes. We have some that are, the smallest would be 3 stories. We have a lot that are 4 stories. We have a lot that are 7. We have a lot that are 9 stories. So it all depends. And you would think, you know, kind of naturally, not talk about single barrel being top floor only, you would think, okay, 9 floors versus 7 or versus 4 floors would be easier to make single barrel whiskey if that's a top floor whiskey only, but it doesn't happen at all. It depends really on where those barrel houses are located. Probably depends on, you know, how, you know, the sun hits them, how the airflow is really in those houses. So there's more to it than just building a bigger box, right? You know,
sure.
So you want to make sure that you're doing things that are going to help mature the whiskey.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And it's not just heat, right? So we've, you know, in our past, we've done lots of experiments with cycling houses, heating them up in the winter, cooling them back down. You know, you, it was just like you were saying in Texas, you know, 100 and whatever degrees you were saying. You're going to drive extraction, right, with that, but very little else, right? Sure. You're not going to really drive oxidation that much or esterification and these reactions that slowly occur over time, which is, in my opinion, just as important.
As
yet,
extraction.
You can get a darker whiskey quicker with extraction.
Sure.
Right? You're going to get more wood in the liquid more quickly, but there's a lot of other things going on that you just you can't really
cut corners.
Cut that, right. Yeah. There's a minimum, and I think every distiller is different. You know, I think in general, we're really good here around that six-year mark. That's just a great spot for us. I've worked at other distilleries where I would tell you 8, maybe 9 years was a really great spot. So it depends on the type of barrel, you know, that you're getting. It depends on the spirit itself that you're putting into the barrel. And, of course, it depends on the target that you want to put in a bottle.
Mm-hmm. The absolutely, because I had went on a maker's trip and we had tasted through you know, I think they shine at that 5-6 year mark at makers. Mm-hmm. Tried some 8 year makers, and it was the most. And they specifically extracted some 8 year makers to show you how it's better at this 5 and 6 year mark.
Yeah.
And Heaven Hill, great example, 8 to 10 years. I think they are fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you guys have been, as everyone has said, just killing it with that full barrel proof program of just, and it's a nice young barrel too. It sucks that you guys can, you know, by ramping up as much as you have and keeping it at 5, that means you're going through a lot more barrels than any other distillery, right? Not just the fact that you sell more, but if everyone's selling 10-year-old, you know, Four Roses, that's been, you're going to go through a lot more barrels if you sell them earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic at 6 years. So
it is. Yeah, like I say, you know, 6 years is a pretty good, you know, earmark for our single barrel. Generally, we're going to be around that, you know, sure, maybe a few months younger or whatever. You know, we don't hold it to a number. When we reach the color, the flavor, the aroma that we want, we're going to bottle it. But I would say, you know, if you had to hold me to one number, that would be about where I would like to be.
How many people do you have tasting through stuff to?
We've got multiple tasting panels, a couple different quality control labs. So we put a lot of focus on the new make whiskey, right? Because we know a barrel's not going to mess it up.
Sure.
It's just going to make it better. The barrel is going to make the whiskey better, excuse me. So we actually taste the whiskey right when it's distilled. So when it's coming off of the still, we'll taste it then as it goes through our charcoal mellowing process every day, because we're looking for very specific things there. And then we'll taste it again after it's come through that charcoal, and we have basically a composite tank of the different vats for the whiskey that's going into the whiskey. So we're going to taste the whiskey at 3 points before it ever sees a barrel.
Sure.
And I know, you know, I find as I travel and talk to people that people think that a master distiller is a taster. And while that's a piece of what we do, you know, I consider a distiller, our job is to distill, right? It's to make that clear whiskey.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We don't make barrels. I mean, here at Jack Daniel's, we do make our own barrels, but we have coopers here. You know, I don't make barrels
just
for a living.
That's not your part of it.
Right, exactly. So while I know the romantic thing, and sometimes the ads and the commercials are all about the taste and the barrel houses and things like that, really what we want to make sure of is that we're putting quality into the barrel.
Sure.
Right, because a barrel's not going to necessarily make it better. I mean, make bad whiskey great, but it's a whole lot easier if you put good whiskey in. You're almost guaranteed good whiskey out. So
you guys can kind of tell where it's going to end up just by tasting it beforehand.
We can have a good idea,
sure,
right? I mean, there's always things. Of course, there's always exceptions, right? So if you look at, you know, Jack Daniel's, you've got sources of flavor, really, the grain, the yeast, and the barrel. That's it. It's the only thing that adds flavor to our whiskey.
Right.
So when you think about that, and it's basically an agricultural product, you know, Mother Nature has a big, big say in it. So once that whiskey goes into that barrel, you know, there's nothing we can do to it. We can't add anything to it, or else it wouldn't be Tennessee whiskey.
Sure.
Right.
Actually, I wanted to talk to you about that.
Sure. So the two samples that we got, or that I pulled. This is a standard single barrel sample that we pulled out about a month ago. Just, I know you guys are here to do some single barrel tasting today, so I thought we'd go ahead and get you acquainted, not that you aren't already. Right. And then I did, just, you know, by luck of what I had in my office, I pulled some samples of our rye whiskey, this is single barrel rye, but this is uncut, completely unfiltered, straight from the barrel, about 128 proof, 127.96.
Are there plans to add that to the single barrel lineup?
You know, possibly. We kick it around. I think it's a great offering.
It's a fantastic offering, and I don't think it gets talked about enough, especially when rye is seeing such a huge resurgence in attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With brands like Whistlepig, Sagamore, MGP in general, yep. Hook, right? Yep. Those are all making huge waves. Mm-hmm. And I've had the first time I ever had your cast strength rye was at one of my events. Costa brought it. It was...
Yep.
It's delicious, right? Yep. And it's so I would like to see that as part of the lineup. Throw that in one vote for whoever you need to tell.
I'll tell Jeff. Jeff. I thought it would be interesting. You know, like I said, we found out you guys were going to be here yesterday, so I was just kind of digging around in the office, and I thought you guys might be intrigued to try some of that. Not many people have had an opportunity to try our rye whiskey straight from the barrel, so it's a good one.
That's exciting. Great. All right,
we'll pour it up. Yep.
That's the great part about being able to work in a facility like this, right? So I work as a safety professional in the petrochem industry, and if I pulled that out of my office, they'd just relieve me of my office, you know?
Yeah.
Well, but here, it's commonplace. It's great.
Well, don't worry. We pay taxes on all this.
That's the whole...
It's all straight edge.
This industry has bucked most typical trends in terms of what's okay and not okay. It's a completely professional environment here where you're... is that all the same?
Same.
Okay, gotcha. It's a completely professional environment that requires you to drink every day on the job, right? It's this weird, thing that gets by.
Yeah, it's the beauty of our industry, right? We're very lucky to be able to work.
Oh, it smells fantastic.
Well, that's literally in the roles and responsibilities, right? Is to be able to taste the product before it leaves.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Where I think everybody knows about tasting and they think distillers taste, and we do, right? I mean, certainly one of our keys is to make sure the quality of the whiskey is what we want it to be, and we are one of many tasters here. That we have a master panel of about 11 people that will taste single barrel whiskeys and approve single barrels because they are standalone batches. So what you're tasting here, 94 proof, our standard single barrel select offering. It's maybe about my favorite product that we make. I think all of our single barrels are kind of in that zone, that sweet spot for us. This is where I really, really like our whiskey. I think 94 proof is also a really good spot for us as well.
And that is amazingly smooth.
I think that you very clearly pick up more of that banana note.
Oh yeah,
in that slightly cut version, and it's a great note. I mean,
yeah,
who doesn't love bananas? I had one all the way here.
Yeah, just a warm up.
Yeah, our yeast creates that note. You know, the yeast, in my opinion, is the number two flavor source behind the barrel.
I think Four Roses would agree with you.
Yeah, sure. I I'm not here to argue or anything. We could debate. But I can tell you from experience and from about 16 years in the industry or a little longer maybe, grain bill, you know, we could take a grain bill and tweak it slightly. And if we put it through our same process, there'd be very little marginal differences, right? Now, not if you go from a Tennessee whiskey to a rye whiskey, but if you just tweaked it from, you know, 80% corn to 75% corn. I'd love to tell you that we're all great enough to hone in on that and taste the exact difference, but we're not. Yeah. However, we can take that same grain bill, and let's say we took yeast from our Old Forester brand up in Louisville, you know, part of the same company, part of Brown-Forman, and we put that in the place of our yeast, the distillate, the new make whiskey would be markedly different. I mean, very easy to pick up on the flavor difference there.
Do you guys collaborate at all? Yeah, I know that with Old Forester's new distillery, they were testing out the new downtown facility. Mm-hmm. They were testing out the how the barrels would age in that warehouse. Mm-hmm. Are you guys, is there any of that?
Not a lot. I mean, we do see, you know, of course, Chris Morris. I've known Chris for a while, worked with Chris when I was on Brown, at Brown-Forman on our campus there for about 9 years in R&D, research and development. So I spent many days at Brown-Forman Distillery, at Woodford Reserve Distillery. Of course, that's well before the new Old Forester facility downtown.
Sure.
But yeah, I've worked in a lot of different distilleries across Kentucky. Probably worked in, I guess, over half of the main ones. I know there's a lot of small micro distillers popping up now, and you know, I haven't worked in any of those, but I've been really fortunate in my career. Of course, I grew up with my grandfather here, and you know, he'll kind of forever be my vision of what a true distiller is, of course, for a lot of different reasons.
Sure.
And then, of course, getting to work for Jeff now is fantastic too. So you know, there are times where we have the opportunity to kick around ideas with Chris and his team up there in Kentucky. But, you know, most of our innovation and our drive is, you know, Jeff, obviously, myself, and we have a core team of, I guess I would call it the innovation team here, where we're looking at, you know, what could we do? What's the potential for this or that? And that's really fun. So
sure. I mean, I sat down with John Campbell at Laphroaig, and he had mentioned, we were talking about a similar thing. You know, when you've got this beautiful beast of a distillery that's so effective at what it does and so impactful, he's like, it's not your job necessarily to innovate as much as it is to keep the machine going.
Oh,
right.
Well,
you're not too much yeah. outside the box. I mean, you'll dabble in things, but he said, just, you know, if you don't change what works, right?
Yeah.
And so I would imagine you guys definitely, of course, Jack Daniel's dabbles in everything. You guys dabble with different proof releases, different, obviously the rye now, you know, you guys are definitely innovating.
Mm-hmm.
But with as much, there's got to be a little bit of a like pressure with the, I mean, Jack Daniel's is the number one distillery in the world. And after hearing you guys have 89 rig houses, I would imagine you're probably also the largest distillery in the world. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'll just say it is and we'll cut it out after.
I don't know. I don't know that we could claim that. We're certainly one of the largest. And, you know, the thing is, we weren't that way until, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I mean, if you think about it, when my grandfather started here in 1957, Old Number 7 was allocated. We only made, you know, that was it. Black Label, Standard, Old Number 7, Jack Daniels that everybody knows. That was allocated until about 1980. Only sold in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So walk into a bar in Houston in 1980, order a Jack Daniels. Guy behind the bar is like, well, I wish I could order some. I tried to order some from my distributor the other day, and, you know, maybe next month I can get a couple bottles.
Sure.
You know,
the Blantons of the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing, you know, when American whiskey went into some really dark times, you know, we endured. We're very lucky that we did, for sure. But if you think about, you know, I'm talking about building a barrel house about once a year. When my grandfather was here, it was every 6 weeks.
Wow.
And it was a 20,000 barrel house. But imagine increasing distillery output by 20,000 barrels every 6 weeks.
While maintaining consistency.
Exactly.
Wow.
So, yeah. So when I say my grandfather is my vision of a distiller, it's for good reason, I think.
Yeah. I'm sure he stayed very busy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is absolutely delicious. Going back to what you said earlier, so the conversation has come up, and this is it's funny. You get in these online forums, and you feel like it's just like, okay, I'm going to ramble for a minute. When I worked in jewelry, you'd get the same, eventually, you work there 6 months, and you've heard every potential question that would come up, right? And I would imagine being here as many years as you have, you've heard all the questions. And almost to the point that when someone asks a question, you already know the answer, not because you had to think of the answer, but because it's almost like a trigger, like it's a button, right? They push this button, that answer comes out. The conversation comes up often, as you know, although it's died down recently a lot, about is Jack Daniel's bourbon. Jeff did an interview with Bourbon Pursuit Podcast where he said it is technically bourbon that goes through an extra process, but it doesn't disqualify it from being called bourbon. And then the other day I hear something new for the first time that no one's talked about. At least I haven't seen it. So I'm just going to say that no one's talked about it, and we'll cut it out after. But the question was, yes, the regulations for Tennessee whiskey define what Tennessee whiskey is, but it doesn't go into as much detail as bourbon regulation, right? So the mentality has always been that there's a, that Tennessee whiskey, a good way of thinking of it is simply a subset, a more specific, a more refined, you know, you've got bourbon being this category, straight bourbon, Bald and Bond, Tennessee, like real just, and you guys hit technically all of those marks all the way down. You guys are as niche and more regulated than any other category within bourbon.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah,
and I'm not dumbing it down, but I'm trying to make it an easy, paint an easy picture. The one thing that's not talked about is that in Tennessee regulation, I don't think there's any stipulation on additives. Meaning, it does mention, you know, age requirements, or not age requirements, but you know, mash bill 51% corn, minimum 51% corn, the Lincoln County process, all these things that we always, obviously, that's on the bourbon checklist. That's on the bourbon checklist. Meaning that theoretically, you could produce a Tennessee whiskey that had up to 2.5% additives, flavoring wise, and it wouldn't qualify as bourbon anymore, but you could still call it a Tennessee whiskey. Meaning that, are you following me?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it explicitly says that there would be no additive. If you go to TTP chapter 4, you know, just because it doesn't explicitly say you can't do something, I mean, it doesn't mean that you can. So well, I don't know that it would be any different.
I think the late great Dave Pickerel might disagree with you, only because of there's all these. I'll give you a great example. There's some the regulation state that you must be in a new make oak container, yep. Right? A charred new oak container, container. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say exclusively, right? So the mentality for some people who are releasing bourbons to market is to. I know someone in Texas that is bringing in American whiskey that was aged 6 years in used barrels. Mm-hmm. They throw it into a new barrel for 6 months, then release it as a bourbon. Mm-hmm. The regulations state you can't, it has to be new at container, but it didn't say exclusively, right? So as long as it hits that.
And that's my point, is its interpretation.
Sure, right.
And so, what you know, I would guess that however Uncle Sam decides they interpret that law,
sure,
they're going to win and we're going to lose.
Yeah.
So again, while it, you know, it doesn't say explicitly like you say, I would anticipate if you added anything to Tennessee whiskey, it would not be allowed. You know, I don't know. Again, you're right. It doesn't say explicitly, but you know, it's not something that we would do here.
Sure. And by no means was I making the implication that you guys do. The backstory with that was, is we were trying to decide, we were having a discussion with Kenny Coleman over at Bourbon Pursuit and Wade Woodard. I don't know if you know Wade, but he's the TTB guy in the forums that likes to, you know, bring things up when he sees that a producer is doing something shady. We were discussing, there's all this, you know, as you know, a lot of producers, if they overproduce a product, they'll sell bulk whiskey off to brokers. As far as I know, I don't think you guys have any distillate out there. You guys are barely keeping up with what you have currently.
Yep.
But Dickel, who we're huge fans of, they've sold off to brokers. And the argument over is something Tennessee whiskey, is something bourbon, comes up because if Dickel is selling bulk whiskey to brands like Barrel, who I'm huge fans of, Joe Beatrice and Will Schragas, over at Barrel, but we're buying 14-year-old, essentially what we know as Dickel distillate or maturate, that's being labeled as bourbon. And if it goes to Lincoln County, so that all that comes up. But then we were having the discussion, there's no way for us to really know if every drop out of Dickel. I have a meeting with Nicole Austin. I'm hoping that she'll clear it up. But there's no way to know that these barrels that were sold off to brokers, every drop goes to Lincoln, even though you know it goes in before Barrel, right?
Right.
The Lincoln County process is supposed to be pre-barrel, so it would stand to reason that unless they specifically plan to sell those off to brokers without going through the Lincoln County process, but there's no way to know because of NDAs. You following me a little
bit? Yeah, I follow you.
We're trying to figure out if it's, could you still, the discussion ended up being technically you could release a Tennessee whiskey that had additives to it and still label it Tennessee only because it's not labeled as a restriction. I definitely know that you guys don't do that, which I think has been openly talked about. You guys are pretty straightforward.
Yeah. I guess the best answer on that is I don't know. Again, I think you would be open to the interpretation of the law, and I think, you know, it would be, again, it would come back to, you know, the decision of the government.
Sure.
Not something that we're going to do or worry about, really. So.
And you probably don't need to speculate on what other distilleries are doing or not.
No, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't asking him to speculate on. Yeah, yeah. Just making sure.
No, I couldn't tell you what's going on anywhere else, but
sure,
it's not done here. So.
Yeah. And that's really what I wanted to get down to is the discussion is that, yes, Tennessee whiskey could be labeled a bourbon, but not necessarily depending on this extra step. You guys are just straightforward, no additives. Just it's again.
I mean, you know, you could take this, you know, Jack Single Barrel, bourbon.
Yeah.
Prove it's not.
Right. Sure. Sure.
Yeah. So it is. Yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. To be very frank about it, if we wanted to be bourbon, we'd just change our label.
Sure.
But our process enables us to put Tennessee whiskey on our label. And so, you know, we believe in that. We spend a lot of money. We invest a lot into that process. You know, and really, our whiskey making process is the best in the industry, period. It is. We're the most traditional distillery process out there, from mashing, yeasting, how we do things. We are the standard bearer of the old-fashioned American whiskey process, in my opinion. So
it hasn't changed much in quite some time.
It's grown a lot, but it hasn't changed much.
Sure, right? Process,
and that's what I was going to ask too, because you have like the lifeblood, I think, is the way that it was described when we did my initial tour, which was about 4 or 5 years ago, but which is the spring, right? That comes out, that it's the mm-hmm. that's the constant, yep. Right? You have the same water, comes out of the same spring. It's like, I believe it was 65 degrees. It's like 2,000 GPMs coming out. And then the tanks, which was kind of where I was transitioning, which is like 500,000. And then the other one's like
10 million
yeah. gallons. And so that's what I thought it was. And you're describing these 89 houses and these two tanks that sound enormous, mm-hmm. but is there any worry of, you know, production wise and things like that? And that spring can only produce so much.
Yeah.
So quickly,
you know, that was the reason we put those tanks in, because we started to project out and seasonally, you know, in the heat of the late summer, and it's typically dry, we might be low on water flow. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's why we put those two tanks in. With 10.5 million gallons, that gives us plenty of water, right, to get through. We believe any catastrophic drought, we're going to be able to pull from that. And plus, we always shut down around August or September anyway, for a month-long, you know, maintenance, cleaning, and everything that would allow us to, during one of the driest parts of the year, replenish our inventory of cave water.
Gotcha.
So that's exactly why we did that, was kind of an insurance to make sure our water would maintain. So, and it starts with that water. And then, of course, our grain bills, 80% corn, 12 malted barley, 8 rye for mm-hmm. Tennessee whiskey. The rye, 70% rye, 12% malted barley, 18% corn.
So how much do you go through on a daily basis through those tanks?
Depends. I'd have to give you an accurate number.
Well, just percentage, what you think, maybe.
Oh, not even.
Not a lot.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No,
that's what I was wondering.
I mean, a few thousand gallons a day, absolutely.
Sure.
Well, that's all going into our mash cookers.
Right. Use your microphone.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So, yes.
Well, I wasn't. Okay.
Certainly a few thousand gallons a day, but it's not. Yeah. We don't use like a million gallons a day. I mean, that's not. No, okay. I mean, nowhere near.
Yeah. But you got a solid backup then, so that's kind of insurance.
Plan. It is exactly.
How long would 10 million gallons last if there was an outage, like a drought, a raccoon clogging the pipeline?
I would say weeks and weeks, months. We can make a lot of whiskey out of 10.5 million gallons of water.
Sure,
a lot.
Sure.
So, and here's the thing: we only use that for production. That water's not used for cooling or cleaning purposes or anything. I mean, we're pulling in water out of Thames Ford Lake, which is about 8 miles to the east, that we bring in for anything that's not going to go in and touch the whiskey, right? So, and even like cut water on the back end, that's not cave water.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be
RO.
RO or deionized water.
Yeah.
Right, going in on the back end, because you wouldn't want to use, you know, that mineral heavy water to cut the whiskey.
Well, the whole limestone thing is a big part of the discussion, and but a lot of people don't realize is that with limestone water, it's usually done in the mashing and distilling process. Bottling, it's not limestone water. It's usually tap water what do you call it? City water.
City water that's been treated, yeah. Because sure. you don't want that mineral content in there. Right. All right, so.
Well, I'm going to kill this coffee and try that rye. We actually have we're doing a barrel selection today. So right after this, we've got a tour first, right?
Yeah.
You can't see off camera, but Chris's wife is right off the camera. Oh, man.
Really jumps on the mid palate.
Oh, I forgot. That's cast strength.
Yeah. Yeah, we're about 128. My chest up.
Good morning.
You guys ever see...
Man, that is great.
With it being only a few years...
Mm.
So, at you're not going to ever see a hazmat release of Four Roses because a single floor rick house is not a lot of temperature variation. They go in pretty early or pretty young. I think 120 into the barrel. I forget. With you guys seeing 9 floors in some of your rick houses,
mm-hmm.
Two questions: where do you pull your private barrels from? Is there a specific part of the warehouse that the private that are allocated, tasted through, and selected for the private barrel process? And two, do you guys ever see some crazy hazmat proofs up in those top floors?
We yes to one, no to the other. So all of our single barrels, whether it's barrel proof, 94 proof, rye single barrel, when we approve those for quality, we never taste a barrel strength. It'll always be cut with water, which in my experience is pretty much industry standard down to around 20 or 25%, which is what we do. Because obviously, if you're tasting 20, 30 barrels at a time, you know, at barrel proof after 3 or 4 samples.
Fred, no, I asked him that question like in episode 2, and he was like, no, I just taste the whiskey.
Yeah, well, it's, you know.
Bill Samuels is the opposite. They cut down 30 proof, 25 proof.
Yeah.
It's very common.
It is. And, you know, I guess everybody has their way of doing it. Here, we're one of them that believes we, you know, to cut it down, especially the aromas, because high proof alcohol will blind you to some things. It will overwhelm subtle differences, and so that's why we believe to add the water. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's sure. just our thing.
Sure.
Secondly, yes, we have seen over 140 proof come out of a barrel before. I know I've seen 140.4, you know, close to 141. That would have been a 5-year-old barrel coming off the fourth floor of a,
really?
Of a, you know.
Wow.
And, you know, honestly, most of our 9-story houses we do not get single barrel out of. They don't perform as well as our 7s and our 4s. In general, right?
Sure.
It's a generality.
Wait, sure. I'm sorry. Say that one more time.
A lot. Some of our 9-story barrel houses will not produce the character in the whiskey that our 7 and 4-story houses will for single barrel.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, for instance, we have some 4-story houses that sit a little farther west, and it's more in an open field. I don't know why, but it's those are some of Jeff's favorite houses, right? I mean, they do make really rich, dark whiskeys, but they're not nearly as big as some of the other ones. Some of these that you see around the distillery, some of our oldest ones, which I kind of tend to favor those just because they're our oldest barrel houses. The history of them, you know, they just have that classic look. They're 7 stories high. For instance, we have a couple of hills right here behind the distillery, Tanyard Hill, Coy Hill, a little farther up. You know, those are some of my favorites that we get a lot of single barrel whiskey from. But some of our 9-story houses, a lot of those sit kind of down in a valley, and they just typically don't, not to say that sometimes they don't, they do, but typically we don't get a lot of single barrel out of those houses. So, you know, that's kind of the quirky thing about whiskey. It's this mix of science and art, you know, like we were talking about, that there's always an exception, right? Mm-hmm. Always.
So what is that process? Do you have someone, you know, let's say you want to allocate, as you mentioned, 100 barrels for the barrel proof program, and someone goes out and is tasting through, and they're tasting through for something, but something about it says this would be great as a single barrel, and they pull it for a single barrel program. Mm-hmm. So that's just typically what happens?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. So when we put barrels away, so today we're going to make whiskey, and we're going to look at where are we going to age this, because once it's in there, it's not going to be moved. So we want to go in and look at every month and make sure that we're putting some whiskey on top floors, right? doesn't necessarily have to be a specific barrel house, but we're putting whiskey away every month that are on the very high floor of certain houses.
Sure.
And so we project that out 5-6 years later to make sure that we've got something to go in and start looking at that we believe will be single barrel color. And the thing is, like, I can go in and look and not only every barrel house see what we're going to anticipate, let's say, in 5 years for color development, for yield, for quality ratings that we get for the taste. Mm-hmm. I can do that on every single floor for every single barrel house we have. And so, you know, we've been doing it 153 years, right? I mean, we kind of know. A correlation I draw a lot of times is like real estate. So we know certain houses, top floor, that's your oceanfront property, right?
Sure.
So that's, we know we've got to get whiskey back in there.
Sure.
You know, if we pull some out, we're going to look at, okay, we got to time this because, you know, in 5-6 years, we're going to need to be pulling some more single barrel from that location.
So you guys go in at 125?
Typically, yes, 125.
And in 5 years, 6 years, you see 140?
Oh, yeah.
Crazy development in 5 years.
Yeah, with no heat cycling.
That's insane.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Especially to end up with a single barrel type products that come out,
yep.
You know,
yep.
Like it these do.
Doesn't
a
happen
lot of
a lot.
39s, but I haven't seen a lot of 140s. I would love, you know, not that I'm fascinated with, not that 140 is better. You know, I think the best product, and I've said this before on the show, I think the best product as far as getting the most out of whatever was in that barrel is how it comes out of that barrel. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, add some water to, like you said, when you're tasting through a bunch of things. I'd like to be able to add the water myself, you know, so I like to buy as is how it came out of the barrel, regardless of what that proof is. I've had mm-hmm. a ton of cash strength that Smooth Ambler had used to bottle some old cash strength single barrels for like 44%. So it doesn't matter what the proof is, as long as it's the whatever the natural product is coming out of the barrel.
Yeah.
So I don't think that necessarily that 140 is or more is the key, but it is pretty fun to see what you
can. Yeah, and we don't see it a lot. I've seen like 2 barrels.
What's the highest you've ever seen?
It was about 141 was the highest I've ever seen here, and it was a little over 5 years old. And I don't even know if that one went into barrel proof. I think that one was probably cut down to 94 for standard single barrel offering. I think that was probably pulled, if I remember correctly, before we even offered barrel proof. So,
mm-hmm. Speaking of innovating, are you guys testing any long-term aging? Like, what's the oldest barrel you have sitting around on the massive property of thousands of acres and 90 brick houses?
Typically, probably around 9 years old. It's probably about as old as you would find here.
Any particular reason or just like, okay, let's say you pull it and it's 9 years old. Is it going into a product or is it just to see what, okay, so it's getting blended?
Could be both. Could be either one. There's no age statement, so there's no hard rule here for one way or the other.
Sure.
You know, could go into a single barrel product, could go into Old Number 7. You know, we don't really know. We don't really set out to say, okay, we're going to get to this number, and this is what we're going to do with it. But yeah, I mean, there's barrels that we have sitting around that we'll look at and say, yeah, we think we can go a little longer. Let's see.
So that's one that's been tasted, and you're like, maturation process, we're going to let this go a little longer.
Yeah, and I'd say the other thing, too, is, you know, depending on where those barrels are at, you know, obviously lower floors, you're going to be able to go longer. Mm-hmm. Top floor, you know, once you start getting to that 9-10-year-old mark.
It's pretty crazy, I bet.
It gets really dark. You know, to me, you know, you start to lose a little balance. Because, again, the distiller made the whiskey, right? And so you don't want the barrel to dominate the flavor. You want it to complement. We want it to complement
the flavor.
You
don't want to oversalt.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
You know, and, you know, everybody has their opinion on that. And, you know, typically, you know, like I say, I think here, if you had to hold me to 1 year, 6 is great.
If you guys went 1 more year as, like, your sweet spot, it would finally give the number 7 a...
Yeah, I know, right? Well, you know, 7... 7-year-old whiskey, depending on where it's at, too, could be dynamite. And we can have 4 or 5-year-old whiskey that's dynamite. Yeah. Could we do a 10, 12, 15? Yeah, sure we can. You know, if we want to just drop it all on the lower floors and keep as much liquid in as we possibly can.
Slow it down, yeah.
Yeah. When I started drinking whiskey, that was, for me, it was like there was a, you know, you get into them where they all have like a 12, a 15, an 18, a 21, all that stuff, right? And you just think, Well, that's naturally, that's how everybody does it, right?
Right.
You just wait this amount of years, then you pull it off the shelf, and here we go, right? Mm-hmm. You just see what you got, good or bad, and you send it out to market. When in theory, right, what you're saying right here makes a lot of sense, right? You actually find the house and the process and everything else, yeah. Where does it define the whiskey the best?
Exactly.
And let it define the whiskey.
Yes, that is the goal. And especially with a single barrel product, right? I mean, then that is ultimate because you're not blending anything else in there. There's no other whiskey coming from a different location that can help balance it out. So if you have a really dry, tannic, woody barrel, you know, you mix that in with some lighter, softer whiskey, and that's going to soften those edges from the wood. So that's a whole different proposition than rather, you know, something like a single barrel, which is what we've tasted here today, where it's standalone if you're going to offer it as a single barrel.
So I've got a good question here. Do you have like a spot, right, in one house out here where you're like, man, that's the gem?
My
like,
favorite one.
Is there like one little spot where this one barrel sits, like number 157 in house so-and-so?
I've got a lot of spots.
Okay.
So our houses are organized based on what property they sit on. So we basically operate on three old farms. Mm-hmm. This is what we call Tract 1, which is where the distillery operations are at. And we have 13 houses here. And then Tract 2 is about a mile and a half down the street where our main bottling and shipping is. We've got pretty close to 50 houses there. And then Tract 3 is about 2 miles farther west from that on the edge of the county.
So you guys buying more, sorry to interrupt.
We do sometimes,
buy more property to do that,
Sure, okay. Absolutely we do. We're not actively doing that right now because we do have plenty of property, but you know we're building our 90th barrel house as we speak, and it'll become the farthest west on our property right now. So there are, you know, I mentioned there's some really cool houses that were built in the 80s down on Tract 3, which is that western part. That a lot of people really love those. Jeff really loves them. So those are kind of some spots that we like. Mm-hmm. I really like this. Probably more from a historical romantic thought, these bigger houses up here at on Tract 1, which mostly were built in the 60s, you know, is when they were done. So that was, you know, back where, you know, the expansion was really taken off. So
yeah. So that's where your prime spot is. I'm just asking purely out of a
fascination.
Well, not really. I kind of had an angle there because, you know, we're about to taste some barrels, so I figured maybe we could pull the
yeah.
He has the best spot reserved for us, you know.
Well, you know, the thing is, everybody's a little different too, and
sure.
And the thing with our single barrels, I mean, honestly, you talk about like favorite spots. Sure, I think we all probably do have our favorite little spots that we like to go to, but sometimes there can be barrels side by side that are remarkably different, and you really don't have an explanation for it.
Sure.
That can happen too. So,
like kids, right? You sound like a parent approach right now. You're like, well, yeah, I don't really have a favorite kid, you know, but at the end of the day, every parent's got a favorite kid. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I thought you were asking because, like, you know, Booker's and Knob Creek are, you know, cross section from parts of the, you know, and then I know that I think Jim Beam White Label lines the walls and the bottom floor because it's the least amount of activity. It's very consistent. So I'm fascinated with it as well. Mm-hmm. Not because I want you to roll out something from your special section, but just, you know, it's interesting how those patterns develop over time. And of course, you guys have to be aware. If you're not paying attention to patterns, then what are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and Jeff and I, we probably get too much credit for that too. I mean, we've got a lot of people that help get our whiskey done here. We've got a lot of great distillers. We've got people in our warehousing, you know, our barrel folks that, you know, they are keeping track of everything to the T. Our distillers over here, I mean, they're fantastic in what they do and getting whiskey. Even our bottling folks are world class. I mean, you know, our bottling facility is state of the art. I mean, we are doing things at a very high level across the process. Mm. And that's the special thing about what we do.
So you guys are putting in 2,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
How fast are you bottling?
About that fast.
Well, I just meant like how many bottles a day is Jack Daniel's bottling? And I mean, you guys
are, I don't even know how to break that down.
Your footprint is in no exaggeration, is not just, hey, we can be found anywhere. No, it's like a really impactful footprint a deep footprint globally. You guys are everywhere. I would imagine you guys have to be bottling, you know, I don't know, 10,000 bottles a day or some crazy number.
Yeah, I mean, we can bottle quite a bit because, you know, we're going to about 170 countries now, close to it, you know.
Mind-blowing.
So, yeah, I mean, most of that is our classic Old Number 7. You know, that's our flagship, right? That's what we do.
Most people cut their teeth with it, right?
Right. And
my first Jack and Coke.
Sure. So that's, we'll ship a lot of cases down there. I don't get involved with bottling, to be just completely honest.
Why would you?
Well, you know, I've at some of my past stops, I've had to, you know, learn a little bit about bottling, but honestly, I know just enough to be dangerous, and so they don't want me down there, and, you know, that's fine with me, too. So when it comes to getting the liquid in the bottle, you know, that's when, once it gets out of the barrel, my involvement is done.
Sure. So. Is there, you know, and I haven't seen anything, but I ask my wife. I'm often behind and missing many things. But what is there anything coming down the pipeline that's, you know, that you guys have recently announced or working on that's coming up? That, you know, I mean, like we did the Sinatra bottling a couple years ago, the 150th anniversary last, or was it two years already? 3 years? God, time flies.
Yeah, three.
You guys are. It seems like every year you're putting out something new.
Yeah, last year was the Heritage Barrel, single barrel,
done very well. A lot of great feedback on that. I've never actually seen actively. I'm sure you guys pay attention to the Facebook, so, you know, secondary market. And stuff. I've seen people actively looking for it, and people have been very happy with it.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was an excellent. An excellent product. We've got a few of those barrels hanging around that we're continuing to watch. The big thing right now, as far as the innovation standpoint that I'm involved with, is our Tennessee Tasters line. Doesn't do a lot of help for you guys in Texas, but it's sold here in Tennessee only.
Sure.
We do sell most of it here at the distillery, though, so while you're here today, you can keep an eye open for that over in our bottle shop at the Visitor Center.
Perfect.
So there's a couple different things, and so we're right now gearing up for what's going to come next on that, so we're working on that. So,
do you guys ever experiment, going back to experimenting with ages and proofs and whatnot, experiment with any other kind of wood besides?
Yeah, one of the first Tennessee Tasters releases we did was a hickory stave insert. Ooh. That we did. We released that.
What does that mean?
Back in October. What we did was every October we have, much like the Houston Livestock show that they have with the barbecue competition, sure, we have the Jack Daniel's World Invitational barbecue competition here, which is smaller, obviously, than the one in Houston, but very
of course,
prestigious.
The food's better in Houston, guys.
And so. Maybe the barbecue, not the whiskey. Got him. So, no, I'm kidding. But what we did was, no, hickory, obviously, classic Tennessee hardwood, right? There's a lot of people are using that to smoke the barbecue. We thought, well, wouldn't it be cool for the 30th anniversary, which was last year, 2018, to do a hickory finish whiskey from us. So what we did was we took small staves that were charred, and inserted them down through the bung of about 50 barrels and let it sit basically all summer long.
So as it's laying horizontally, you just put it in there like you would dangle.
Mm-hmm.
And, yep. and would it be attached to the bung and sealed or just hanging over? You know, the opening
submerged all the way in and then rebunged, then a new bung put on to seal it off.
Dropped in, okay, like an ice cube. Okay,
yeah, like an ice cube. So like 20, and they were small, so probably about a third of the size of a full stave. You know, to cut them down so they would fit in the barrel.
Yeah,
and charred on both sides, and just let that flavor infuse into the whiskey through all of last summer, basically. And
were those labeled Tennessee whiskey?
Tennessee whiskey with hickory stave insert.
Okay, so
have to call it out.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was going back to.
Per hour additives. TTB specialist, that has to be called again.
Sure,
again, doesn't say explicitly you can't do that, but
just to be safe. Yeah, there's a guy that started a company in I think they're based out of Texas. They're bottling in Texas, but they're sourcing product and they're throwing a stave in the bottle. And they had to get switched from bourbon to specialty because they threw the stave in there, which made me wonder.
Mm-hmm.
I'll definitely want to try the mesquite. I mean, is it that
hickory.
One?
Hickory and Husky.
Sorry, but that stave is, or that specific bottling is in the bottling.
It should be. Yeah, it should be. It's in a 375 with like a white label on it. Tennessee Tasters. You can't.
I saw the Tennessee Tasters. There was a liquor store we stopped at last night that we stopped to pick up some Dos Equis.
And that's just a Tennessee release.
Yeah.
So I have a friend who asked me specifically. He said, when you go to Jack Daniels, he's a giant fan.
Cool.
And he's never been here, which I don't
understand. Is this Ian? Well,
it is Ian. And he was supposed to come on. He was supposed to be on the trip with us, right?
He wanted to come last minute, but when you try to book a flight last minute, it's $1,000 to Tennessee.
$1,000 from Houston to Tennessee. And then, really? we get on the plane, and there's like 10 open seats.
Oh, wow.
And I said, what kind of business? I don't understand this business plan.
It's because they're $1,000 a ticket, right?
You know, just raise the price so nobody buys them. I don't know. We'll see how that airline does.
Delta or United? I think they're going to be okay.
Yeah, United's doing all right. Kind of having cornered.
Sure.
But yeah, he asked if there was anything in particular here that you cannot get in Texas and what those bottles were. And he was like, just call me on what those are so that I know. Mm-hmm. And bring me some back. He's like, whatever it is, I'll reimburse you, but bring them back. So far I have two recommendations, what it sounds like.
Yeah, that Hickory, and then we've also released earlier this year our first barrel finish. Well, I won't say our first because we've done some stuff with maple barrels with our 27 Gold product, which is beautiful. But
great product.
On this one, we were talking, you know, an innovation around barrel finishing, and all that's being done so common.
We did an interview with Bell Mead yesterday. And yeah, their footprint, their stamp is finishes, right?
Yeah. Well, we felt like, you know, what we should do for this Tennessee Tasters line is, since we have the benefit of making our own barrel, is to make sure that if we use a finishing barrel, that it's our own barrel. So there's this homecoming aspect to it. So the barrels that we finished in were used at a Tennessee winery to make red wine. They buy our barrels once we've used them. And then we bought them back, and when we got them back, we then finished our whiskey in the red wine barrels, which were ours. Those were in there between 4 to 5 months, I believe. I should have looked before I came in, but it was around 4 or 5 months. Again, there was no set. It's got to do this. It's got to be that. It was once we get the character and the flavor into the whiskey, let's get it out. But those were bottled back around the holidays. And they were probably refilled, you know, at some point last summer. So, you know, 4 or 5, maybe 6 months, somewhere in that range.
And when's this being released?
It is out right now. That's our other Tennessee Tasters release that you can find in our gift shop. And it's called Barrel Reunion.
Sure.
Because of the fact, obviously, it was a barrel that we made and we used. Mm-hmm. It left and then it came back.
So. Are there plans to do anything with sherry or honey or, you know, like
that?
We had a fantastic, I really can't rave about it enough. Bell Mead gave their barrels to a local honey farm, got them back, aged their whiskey in a honey barrel. The influence is very tastefully done, like in a very positive way. And, you know, I know that people are quick to write certain things off like that, but are there any plans to do anything like that? Any kind of...
Yeah, I mean, you know, anything's in the world of innovation. Everything's on the table. You know, I think... It comes back to, are we going to create something that maintains balance in what we want, you know, in our whiskeys? But then again, you know, we may try something that doesn't work as well.
Sure.
And we've done that before. You know, I mean, we've done, you know, with our own cooperage and barrels. You know, we've taken barrels that we've used and then put them in a steam chamber, flipped them inside out, re-toasted, recharred. What was the outside? Because that's new oak, right?
Sure.
It looked really wild, but it leaked like crazy because, you know, the staves aren't thick enough to you know, double cut them.
Sure.
And so you know, we've, you know, just case in point, we'll consider anything. Yeah, right.
That's pretty interesting test, like a trial. You took a barrel, broke it down, cut off the charred outside to expose the wood under.
And no. The char that was on the inside became the outside, so the outside. Oh,
so you
of the
left
barrel
the char on the
black.
Outside, so you got them. You got them wet enough that you could bend them back.
Bend them back
them.
The other way, exactly.
And then recharred the inside.
Yeah.
Could you call that bourbon?
It's new charred oak, right?
I would imagine, yeah.
It was a complete failure. I don't want to mislead anyone here.
Sure.
It did not work. But
it sounds awesome though.
So how long ago was
I'm
that?
I'm picturing it, right? With this charred outer side.
It looked pretty cool. This black barrel here. Like, wow. But that was when I was in R&D. That would have been early 2000s, somewhere in there. That we've done thousands of experimental trials. Sure. Here with warehousing, with barrel houses, and it could be as simple as cycling, could be as simple as making a change to a barrel. You mentioned our Sinatra whiskey with the Groove. We sure. started working on that. Mm-hmm. 2003, 2004, we had no idea that it was going to eventually be this tribute to Frank Sinatra and his relationship with Jack Daniels. We were just experimenting. What could we do to drive new flavors, in our whiskey? Because of this resurgence of American whiskey, I think you find so many people are trying to latch on to something to market, and to come up with a marketing story. And it's kind of funny. It's a lot of things that we've done years, decades ago here. And we just,
long before
it didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Small barrels, big barrels, all these inside-out barrels.
Inside-out barrels. That's crazy. That really is crazy. Well, we've run out of time. I've got a... We've been in an hour. I know Jack's probably screaming at the camera right now, but thank you so much for doing this. This was fantastic.
Absolutely.
Please get those rye barrels in part of the program. I'll take one now.
Yes.
I just really appreciate it. Thank you so
much. Yeah, thank you, guys. I've really enjoyed it. Love talking whiskey. Of course, we had a little bit to make sure we're doing our job.
Nice and warm, woken up. Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate it. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Thanks.